Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Tires matter. They're the only part of your vehicle that touches the road. Tread confidently with new tires from Tire Rack. Whether you're looking for expert recommendations or know exactly what you want, Tire Rack makes it easy. Fast, free shipping, free road hazard protection, and convenient installation options. Go to TireRack.com to see tire test results, tire ratings, and consumer reviews, and be sure to check out all the special offers. TireRack.com, the way tire buying should be.
Hey everyone, Logan Medish of High Caliber History and the host of the No Low Ballers podcast here. If you're passionate about firearms, accessories, and everything in between, there's one place you need to check out, GunBroker.com. Whether you're looking to buy, sell, or just browse, GunBroker is the world's largest online marketplace for firearms, ammunition, and all the gear that you need. It's a trusted platform that connects buyers and sellers across the U.S., offering everything from rare and collectible firearms to the latest models. Plus, with a wide range of accessories, parts, and ammo, GunBroker.com is a one-stop shop for gun enthusiasts of all kinds. So whether you're an experienced gun owner or you're just getting started, make sure to visit GunBroker.com to find exactly what you're looking for. And don't forget, you can also tune in to our No Low Ballers podcast to hear more about the history behind your favorite firearms, sponsored by GunBroker.com. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the No Low Ballers podcast. I'm your host, Logan Medish of High Caliber History, as always joined by my partner in crime, Alan Faulkner. And today we've got a fantastic guest, a repeat guest. We have our good friend, Caleb Daniels from Commando Bond. Caleb, welcome back
to the show. It is awesome to be here, guys.
I'm always happy but surprised when people come back.
Well, you know, I knew Logan before the show, yeah. And then I still agreed to the show, so the likelihood of me coming back is probably higher than most.
So what you're saying is you're not very smart.
I'm ready to be heard again, guys.
Oh, goodness. Well, for the folks who've been longtime listeners and watchers of the show, you'll remember that we first sat down with Caleb when we were in Arkansas at the Walther plant, and we were talking about, you know, all things Walther firearms, Walther history, and of course James Bond guns, and the iconic PPK and the P99 and all sorts of fantastic 007 stuff. And in that episode, we briefly touched on the fact that at that point in time, Caleb was working on writing a book with Headstamp Publishing all about the guns of James Bond. And that was, you know, forthcoming. We didn't have a release date for that. But we now have a lot more details about that book that he's been writing. So we're going to kind of talk, you know, obviously we're going to talk guns and James Bond and stuff like that. But I really want to get into the kind of nitty gritty of writing a gun book, because it's an interesting world. And, you know, and Caleb, you've just gone through all this, and I was actually part last year. I was dumb enough to take on not one, but two, editing and rewriting of some books for publication. And it's a painful world. And you know, like you said, I'm ready to be heard again. So, you know, yeah, tell us, Caleb, you know, give us the title of the new book, 'cause I think it has changed since we last talked, last November, and give us, you know, give us the lowdown on the book.
Yeah,
so
we officially launched with our final title, which is Licensed Troubleshooter, The Guns of James Bond. That actually began its pre-sale. So like we're really running and gunning these days, which is really exciting. That launched Thursday, September 12th, which is kind of crazy because, you know, here we are a few days later and we are closing in on the $300,000 mark in the pre-sale process via Kickstarter, which... huge thanks to everyone who supported it right out of the gate. It's been a very humbling experience kind of watching everything come together after the last few years. So that's the title of the book. Sure. It's taken me, since we saw each other last, you know, I saw you guys in Arkansas with Walther, but since then, Walther was gracious enough to send me to Germany. I spent a few days with the owner of the firm and we went to both Ulm and Arnsberg through all the private collections. And with the fleeting time that I did have, we were able to capture some incredible pieces. I got to handle not one, but four WA-2000s, which was insane, including one of the two screen-used rifles from The Living Daylights. So
he's not bragging. It's okay. He's not bragging.
No. It's just one of those true once-in-a-lifetime experiences that I somehow had to have. So it's been a crazy few months since I saw you guys. It's hard to believe we're closing in on a year since we sat down in Arkansas, but here we are, and I am just so happy that we are as far along as we are in this process. So pre-sale is going to run till mid-October, yeah. October 11, I believe. And then at that point, we hope to take delivery of the books no later than like April of 25 and get them out to people as soon as possible after that. Because to your point, the book production process is a pretty intense affair. You know, it's not just I passed a manuscript over and then things magically happen. Yeah. You know, we're finalizing edits. Part of the pre-sale with the Kickstarter, which is how Headstamp launches a lot of these self-published books that they do, is it also includes additional goals, right? So one of the caveats of it is if we hit particular dollar amount thresholds, I have to work more. There's additional sections that get added to the book. One of the ones that we've kind of talked about a lot that I think is exciting that people will want is The Guns of GoldenEye N64. Doing a highlight and breakdown of that. So that's one of the big Kickstarter goals. It hasn't been unlocked. It's not even visible yet. As we're speaking today, it might be by the time this airs, but that's a really exciting goal that okay. I'm hoping to do. I mean, when I was in Utah with the 1911 Syndicate, I finally, after years of dreaming about it, got to shoot some VZ-58s, got to shoot some Scorpions with Silencer Co. in their basement range, and two suppressed Scorpions at the same time. It was a great time.
I was going to say, you had to do a wield 'em, right?
Absolutely.
Full John Woo.
Did one jam? Yes. Did I dump both magazines all the same? Absolutely.
Oh, that's awesome. And I love that you mentioned when you were in Germany about the WA2000.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Because in our episode that we did with you back in Arkansas, we talked about those guns and how rare they were. And at that time, you're like, God, I'd love to get my hands on one. You know, little did you
know. Here I am wish casting about it. And then they left me alone in the owner of Walter's office with the keys to all of his private gun cases with a full pot of coffee and with that WA2000 already out in front of me. And they're like, yeah, we'll be back in a couple hours. Do your thing. And, you know, talk about just the best afternoon of my life.
Yeah, no kidding. We won't tell your wife you said that, but...
You know, you kind of touched on something that I think most people don't really realize about the book process. I think, most of us, and especially the gun community, read something, we're like, I can write that. I mean, come on, I can do that. They think you just sit down in front of the word processor, spew it out on the pages, it's good to go. But the level of research work and just legwork and paperwork and tracking stuff down you've done for this has been incredible. Can you talk just a little bit about that process?
Yeah, absolutely. I will say this book took me about 2 years from when we started the writing process to where we sit today. And I want to emphasize that it only took 2 years because I had spent the vast majority of my life prior to that being an obsessive nerd on the vast majority of the topic area that I'm writing about. I've read all the Fleming novels, copious amounts, like aggressively. Like I have the 1960s paperbacks covered and bound aggressively in packing tape because I've hiked Alaska. I grew up going to Colorado once a summer, and I always had one of those in my back pocket or two or three in my backpack when I was in high school. So I've lived in those books and those movies my whole life, and I've worked in the firearms industry now for going on 10 years. So if it wasn't for having like at least some sort of baseline knowledge on these subject matter, this would have been decades in the making, getting everything together the way we did. And even still, I had so many books inside the Bond canon that I hadn't read because my book covers the literary James Bond of Ian Fleming in addition to all the continuation authors. And I had read a good chunk of those, but the John Gardner books of the 1980s, he wrote about 15, 17 novels, I think. I had never really read all those. They're kind of hard to get through. They're like true dime store paperbacks sometimes. Other times they're reasonably good. Other times they're really, really bad. And so I had just never put capital into them. Last summer, I, in a span of a month and a half, read every single one of those books cover to cover to catalog every single firearm used because, we might live in the age of the internet, which in theory means that you have access to any piece of information, but that reality is you only have access to the information that has been cataloged. A lot of this stuff hasn't been, which is why a project like mine has legs, right? Because, this stuff has not been adequately discussed or cataloged. And so it's been a lot of that. And I'm very blessed too, not only on the research side, but this project would not have happened in the time frame that it did if I hadn't been in the industry as long as I had, if I hadn't had the relationships that I've had over the last few years that I've cultivated, not only through my actual professional career, starting at like 17, working a gun counter and then moving up into a marketing, but also through the Commando Bond account, right? Like I've built authentic relationships with a lot of these brands that were willing to take a chance on me because they knew who I was. It opened a lot of doors that definitely wouldn't have been opened otherwise. Such a blessing there. And so that catapulted us and elevated the quality of the project dramatically each time. But then you get the first draft done and you think you're there and then it completely gets eviscerated and you start over again. And then it goes to a technical review and then you start it all over again. And then you do that. I mean, I have a nasty habit of being wordy if you haven't noticed by listening to this podcast already. I got less than halfway through the book and realized that I was going to, if I kept at the pace and the quantity that I was writing at that time, this was going to be like an 8-volume affair based on what Headstamp's usual word count cutoff was. I had exceeded their standard word count for a book by about 20% halfway through the subject matter. And so I took a machete to it and then I had to start all over again. And then also just kind of talking about the technicalities of this particular subject matter, there's a lot of complexity in the organization of a book like this too. And you wouldn't think it'd be hard, but you've got 50, 60 books, short stories, et cetera. And then you've got 25 official films plus a bunch of non-official films that are all covered in one capacity or another. And a lot of them have the same firearms. So how do you organize a book without being hyper repetitive in a way that consistently and honestly gives you a storyline?
You had a little additional challenge too, in that a lot of the firearms that you want to talk about, you know, really only exist in rumor. You know, they're not exactly something you walk down to your local Cabela's and grab off the shelf, or, you know, call a friend who has one in his safe. So, you know, you had to kind of winnow through the lore of the gun industry to get to the actual facts on some of these.
Yeah, that was the other big thing too. I want to thank Keith Ford, a good friend of mine, very, very much for getting me into an amazing private collection. You'll see his name at the top of the line when you see the acknowledgments of the book, because that in and of itself is going to be like a chapter, because of what you just mentioned there, Alan. The amount of people that I've worked with to get this project off the ground, to get pieces into it, some of them just literally don't exist, right? Like the Golden Gun or that Moonraker blaster. You know, I had a friend who is an incredible engineer who actually fabricated that. He 3D printed it, but he actually CAD designed the whole file himself by scanning in an Uzi, adding slight percentages to it to make it look like the original toy, printed it, and did the whole thing. And he's only ever done two of those, and the prototype of it we gifted to my friend Jack Carr, and it sits in his library. So, you know, all of this That's stuff really means a lot to me. And I think it's, to your point, it's telling the amount of wheeling, dealing, smiling, emailing, begging, scraping, and traveling that has been done to get this book together. I mean, we head stamp went to the Royal Armouries in the UK. We went to Germany. We've attended multiple private collections. And even then, we didn't have all the firearms needed. So, you know, we've worked with a bunch of other folks inside the industry. Head stamp has a long tradition of working with like Rock Island Auction House to kind of fill in some of those blanks, and they were super helpful in that process. Griffin and Howe was a huge asset. We couldn't locate a proper Holland and Holland in the style that we needed. Griffin and Howe is one of the most prestigious gun clubs in the country, also happens to be a great importer of Holland and Holland double rifles, and they were able to get us a perfect matching version of the Royal to double shotgun, rather, in this case, for the Moonraker section for a Roger Moore gun, because if you've seen any Roger Moore movies, there's not a lot of gunplay. And so when there is a gun, it's kind of hard to skip over it, because then you're just losing out. And so getting that in there meant a lot to me, and it meant even more to put, you know, photo by Griffin and Howe on a page, because to me, this book is a celebration of the industry as a whole, and not to sound like some sort of socialist, but it really does feel like a book that's by the community and for the community, because so many people came together to actually make it a reality. And it genuinely wouldn't, it would be a self-published piece of, you know, magazine at best if it wasn't for the efforts of everyone involved.
Yeah, it truly does take a village, you know, and that's one thing that people don't necessarily realize about our industry is that, it's big, it's massive, it's global, but at the end of the day, it's actually very small, and as much as we give each other shit about a lot of things all the time, we really do try to lift each other up, and, you know, especially when it seems like the whole rest of the world is against us and against the industry, you know, we've got no one to rely on but ourselves, and so it's very refreshing to experience and to hear that, you know, that the gun community as a whole has been so receptive in helping make this a reality, because that's just huge. And I don't think you'd necessarily find that in other industries like we do.
I think you're exactly right. This is an industry that fully understands that the blacklisting, the social stigma associated with us really requires not only like guerrilla marketing, but like true guerrilla efforts at every step of the way. I mean, if it wasn't for the people sticking their neck out for me or vouching for me if someone else didn't know me, and having a coterie of folks that could all just kind of collaborate, confirm my story and whatever, we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have this book. I wouldn't be able to say that I'm going to be a published author, which has been something I want to do my whole life. So this means a ton to me.
Yeah, we're very proud of you. I mean, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, I've known you for a long time, and it's been really cool to watch the whole evolution of this, you know, over the past decade or more that we've known each other. On a personal level, I'm very proud of you, Caleb. It's very cool that you've been able to pull this off, because it is undeniable how passionate you are about this project and your willingness to take on what is such a very large undertaking. I mean, people who have never written a book or been part of writing a book don't understand, you know, just how laborious it can be. And thankfully, you know, with the Headstamp guys, you've got a great group of people to work with, and you know, they are technical folks. It helps when your editors and other people understand the subjects that you're dealing with, which is a luxury that I myself did not have when I was working on these two books past couple years. Well, for starters, I was working with a publisher over in England. And so there was always the time difference with this and that. And they were more of a generalist publisher. And so I was educating them on everything related to the firearms world in a book that, you know, they had published. They were publishing and they knew nothing about what was going on. And so it's a little frustrating when you have to do the education on top of all the research and the writing, but that is not the case with the Headstamp crew. No,
it's quite the opposite. In fact, it's been educational for me across the board, because obviously you've got true SMEs in their field between James Rupley and Ian McCollum, who take this at a very academic and serious approach. So we're always challenging one another to do better and to learn more and to understand the material. You know, I might see something and assume it's X, but then they're able to flesh out a little bit more about that story that I just don't know because they read about it in a book that's been out of print for 50 years that I couldn't locate. You know, I think that's the other big thing in this industry. Yeah. Is I touched on it earlier with the Bond subject matter. There's so much of that that's not documented online, that's easy to find. And I'm very big proponent in building physical libraries. I've got a bookshelf right here that's about to fall over on me. But to that end, there's only so many books you can find if you even know what you're looking for. And so when you have folks that have been doing it for so long, that can go, well, actually, here's some really niche information that I squirreled away many years ago that I never thought would be relevant, but fits this project immaculately. Let's fold that in. That's really cool. And then, of course, too, because the other thing that Headstamp granted me, aside from, I think, also helping open a lot of those doors, right? Because I had the Vickers Guide series, I had Ian's books that I could fall back on and go, hey, this is who I'm partnering with. The project that we're doing means business. This isn't just a fantasy concept. This is going to happen. That helped get doors open, without a doubt. But then also, you've got so many people that are just excited because they get to be included in such a beautiful volume. I think that's the most important thing too, because the finished product that they produce is pretty unrivaled in our space right now. That means a lot to folks to have their projects and their efforts put in there. But then also it opened some really cool doors with other subject matter experts. You know, I think we talked about this in our last show together about how the book covers some real world history and the use case of these firearms by actual commandos and other folks like that. And because of the Headstamp backing, because of the backlog of work they'd done, it was really easy to sit down with Navy SEALs, DSS operatives, British commandos, SOG operatives, just the whole nine yards of folks that had tools that had been influenced by James Bond or vice versa, to share those stories within our book as well.
Mm-hmm. No, it's amazing. And I knew, you know, that the book was much more than just the guns of Bond, but it's been really interesting, you know, in reading the background on the book from the Kickstarter and stuff, how much it goes beyond just James Bond to encompass the real world history that all of this literary and film stuff is based upon. It's really an incredible depth and breadth of work to delve into.
I think we all assume that the books were influenced by the real world, but the amount of real world that were influenced by the books and the films has been a little surprising as well.
Yeah, it's a really fun balancing act between the two, and it's fun kind of juxtaposing those pieces of history against one another and discussing just here's how Bond impacted and frankly almost got Princess Anne killed, for instance. Like, that's a fantastic story to be shared in the book about the attempted, there was a attempted kidnapping, hopefully not an assassination, but an attempted kidnapping that occurred, and her bodyguard was armed with a Walther PPK, and it jammed. And the only reason everyone came out okay is because a policeman jumped out of the crowd, he gets shot, and then a boxer jumps out of the crowd as this as they're processing by, and he takes down the assailant. And so it was on that day they barred the PPK from service. Well, of course, you know, it's never said directly, but the obvious implication is the only reason why the British would be carrying the Walther PPK in the 60s post-war era is because of their pop culture icon doing the exact same thing. And so that that actually influenced the whole John Gardner run of books. The first four novels he writes in the 1980s come on the heels of that kidnapping, assassination attempt, whatever you want to call it. And so he brings the real world into the world of Bond and goes, okay, the PPK got barred from service. He actually discusses that event in great detail. And then he goes on this four-book journey trying to figure out what Bond's next sidearm should be. So that's kind of a fascinating way of how Bond influenced the real world. The real world then influences Bond.
That's wild how it's all intertwined. And I had no idea about the Princess Anne event. I mean, that is absolutely crazy.
I've got to that in the Royals yet. I thought I was to that era, but I just haven't seen that yet.
It's crazy.
Hey, everyone. Alan Forkner from the No Low Ballers podcast here, and I'm talking to all the collectors and firearms enthusiasts out there. If you're on the hunt for exclusive high-end firearms, then look no further than CollectorsEliteAuctions.com. This is the premier auction site for serious collectors who are looking to find rare and collectible firearms, accessories, and memorabilia. At Collectors Elite Auctions, every auction is carefully curated, featuring some of the most sought-after pieces in the country. Whether you're looking to expand your collection or find that one unique item, this is where top-tier firearms meet serious bidders. And with easy-to-use online bidding, it's never been simpler to add items to your collection. So if you're ready to take your collection to the next level, or get started collecting, visit CollectorsEliteAuctions.com and start bidding today. Oh, and don't forget to listen to the No Low Ballers podcast, where we dive into the history of firearms and the stories behind some of these incredible pieces. Brought to you by GunBroker.com.
So you had mentioned, you know, having to cut down your word count by a tremendous amount. You know, what was your process for figuring out, you know, what gets cut, what gets kept? And then obviously, you know, with the stretch goals in the Kickstarter campaign, you've got to leave a little bit of breathing room for the possibility of adding things back in. So, you know, how, as someone who is all encompassed in the world of Bond and Bond arms, you know, how do you bring yourself to leave something out? And when you do, how do you justify that?
Yeah, that was definitely the hardest part of the process, aside from learning what guns we may or may not be able to include based on their availability or realism or whatever the case may be. So, you know, there was these warring things that were happening because I am a pretty deep level detail individual. I really enjoy the research side of it. I enjoy sharing these little semantic stories that exist that people might not know about, because the reality is, for me, this book, for the non-gun people, for the Bond fans that will be purchasing it, my hope is that this is the book they keep out and they have their morning coffee with, or, you know, a nightcap, and they might just read one section while they sit there. They pick up some cocktail conversation and they want to return to it when they can. I don't expect those types of folks to sit there and read it holistically cover to cover right out of the gate. I'd love if they did, but I know that I might retain the audience for particular parts of time. And so like a museum curator, as James Rupley told me, you know, it was my responsibility to curate the most important stories that I felt were the most critical to sharing this story. Like, there might be a ton of details or things that I thought were super interesting, but one thing that I discovered, and this was, I think, a real helping hand, was that, you know, I had a very deep level, lifelong passion for the James Bond stuff. And so every once in a while, I would find myself glossing over some of those details to get into the fine line of the guns history. And, you know, Ian and James raised their hand. They're like, what the hell was that one sentence you just threw out there? Could you tell me more about that? We have no idea what you're talking about. Like, I thought that was common knowledge. Like, no one knows what you're talking about. Please spend more time on that. So I'm like, okay,
I thought I was the only one who ever suffered from that.
So, I was like, whoops. So
I love it. No one knows what you're talking about. I feel like that's the story of my life.
You know, I'm over here like, and then this happened. And they're like, time out. You just threw that into the wind, and then you went on about the ASP for another 8 paragraphs. Like, we need you to roll it back and tell us more about this thing that you just thought was common knowledge.
You don't just get to throw a grenade in the
room
and
I think
away.
That was a hard part, too, is because, you know, in my brain, I was educating Bond people about guns to some degree, and I kind of forgot sometimes, and not that I wasn't including the Bond history, but that I might more likely be speaking to a gun audience about James Bond. They might know some decent stuff about the PPK, and there's plenty in that book that I can guarantee they didn't know about the PPK, but they're more interested in its connection to Bond, how it got there, all these things that might be trivial stories to some people are way more than that. Like, I think one of my favorite things that we do cover in great detail that I knew from day one we had to include was that an article out of American Rifleman is how Ian Fleming picked the Walther PPK. Not a lot of people know that. They know the Jeffrey Boothroyd story, right? They know that someone wrote Ian Fleming. But what a lot of people get wrong about that is that Boothroyd had no interest in the PPK. He was very adamant about what folks like Charles Askins and stuff like that were writing about at the time, which was the Centennial Airweight. He really wanted James Bond to carry a 38 special revolver. And Fleming said he wasn't interested. He actually had some experience, with special forces and all that. You know, he was in the intelligence apparatus during World War II for the British, and he actually experienced shooting Sten guns with silencers on them. So he knew the importance of a suppressor for an intelligence operative potentially. And so he was going to, and he knew also you couldn't silence a revolver. So, you know, for all the talk about Fleming not being like a gun guy, he at least had those baseline understandings. So he said, well, I need an automatic pistol. Boothroyd in his letter back says, well, there's this article I read back in American Rifleman in 1953, I think it was written. And he's like, and this guy goes through and he graded all the service pistols from World War II. Fleming asked for that article, and then he transposed the text from that article directly into the novel, Dr. No. So, you know, we get to cover that in really great detail. We get to give you the parallel, and you get to see the words of Fleming right next to the words of that article. Really cool. You know, Headstamp has a tradition in some of their publications previously to getting approval to republish original articles, and we've been granted that. So you're actually going to see, I tracked down an example of that magazine. Rupley photographed it beautifully, and you're going to see those spreads, and you're going to be able to read that entire analysis, that primary source that informed James Bond. And that part of the story gets skipped over dramatically a lot. And so that's something I'm very excited about.
I mean, that makes sense. You're giving him a, you know, Aston Martins with ejection seats and all the other gadgets and gizmos, and then you hand him a, you know, 1880s, 1890s technology firearm, but that doesn't really seem to be on brand. So that would make sense to keep him into a semi-auto.
Yeah, I mean, he liked wheel guns. Don't get me wrong. Fleming had a long affinity for them, and you see him appear occasionally, but he was very adamant that James Bond needed an automatic so he could run a suppressor, and then also that he needed 32 automatic because it was a much more common round in the places he'd be operating. So, you know, he made a conscious decision based on what made the most sense for the character. And so I think that's the other thing that I had the most fun with this. We recently released a video about me and Ian to kind of promote the book. We sat down and we did a video together on how every single gun in the movie Dr. No is the wrong gun. Like, every single firearm is a stand-in for another firearm or a stand-in for a stand-in for a stand-in. I mean, they're like Russian nesting dolls of guns.
Oh, jeez.
And so, but we go through that, and I think what a lot of people missed is they didn't watch the video all the way through, and they're making comments like, I can't believe you guys are ripping this movie up and this, that, and the other. Is make it very, very clear throughout the whole thing. The reason why we love it so much is because it just gave me another 8 guns to talk about in my book. I get so much more to celebrate. You know, we get to bring these guns into the Bond canon, and we get to talk about their history, and we get to celebrate them at a level that it wouldn't have been before because they got slipped onto the set. It's a fact that it happened, and it's an oopsie daisy, but you can look at it in 2 or 3 different ways, and we choose to take it in a very jovial and celebratory way. Like, yeah, this thing happened, and, you know, sure, it's because it was the first movie. They didn't think they'd make another movie. They were happy to get whatever they could to fill in the blanks. But you know what? End result's amazing. And now we can actually tell you, because, I mean, what's my choice here if I'm writing this book? Do I just not acknowledge that fact and just leave it to you to tell me, well, actually, afterwards?
Yeah.
That's not healthy. And I'm certainly not going to tear it a new one because the first 4 Connery movies are flawless. Today, actually, the day we're recording, is the 60th anniversary of Goldfinger. It released on this day in 1964 in London. So,
just how we planned it. I mean, that was Logan and I's thinking behind this. Yeah, we knew that.
Yeah, that was Yeah, that was the whole purpose behind all of this, if for no other reason than that one alone. But I want to back up just a little bit with Boothroyd and remind folks, you know, because that is such a fascinating story about how the back and forth between Fleming and Boothroyd went. And for folks who either didn't catch it or need a refresher, the first time we had you on the show when we were at Walther, we did go in depth about that whole back and forth with Boothroyd and Fleming. So if people either don't remember or didn't catch that part of the episode, definitely go back and check out the previous episode that we did with Caleb and learn more about the whole Boothroyd connection and the revolvers versus semi-autos.
It's always a fun discussion to have. So, you know, it's easy for it to come up. It was really easy for it to come up at Walther because we were discussing the story of how the PPK arrived. But, you know, man.
Sure.
And those are just some of the stories. I mean, I got to, and I'm very, very blessed, you know, with my trip to Germany. There's stories that some people know to some degree, like how the P99 ended up in James Bond's hands. You know, the new owner of Walther hand delivered it onto the set to Pierce Brosnan. And I knew that story like a periphery note because I had heard about it. I had read about it in the Walther German Success Story 2-volume set that Walther themselves put out a few years ago. But hearing about it from Wolf-Heinz Flammer, the owner, the guy who hand-delivered it to Pierce Brosnan and his personal secretary, who has been his partner in crime and an amazing woman since like the 90s. So they've been a team for a long, I think even earlier than that, for a very, very long time. And, you know, she and I spent a lot of time together, and I wouldn't have gone to Germany if not for her. Our friends at Walther USA actually introduced her to me at SHOT Show. And I remember kind of walking up like a school child going to the principal's office because they're like, we're going to introduce you to Monica. Monica can get things done. We want you to go to Germany. We need you to talk to her. And I just kind of remember standing up at her table and politely shaking her hand and just talking to her. And she's like, we will get this done. And in May, I'm in Germany landing, getting picked up by a car with a 007 license plate.
You know, maybe amazing. It's just a rumor, but as I've heard that story told, the reason that he had to hand deliver it on the set is because his wife wanted to meet Pierce. I mean, I don't know if there's any truth to that, but every time we mention that you're on the show, my wife asks if you can introduce her to Pierce. So I,
yeah, like it might just be, you know, happy coincidence, but
could be. Yeah.
It was he was adamant. I mean, the man was just a marketing machine because he bought the company in '93 because they were going defunct. I think we talked about that a lot in our last episode too. And he was like, this gun has to show up in his hands. And one thing that Monica told me that I thought was hilarious was Wolf gets very, when he gets animated, he slips back into German very quickly. He speaks English, but he falls back into, like so many people, they fall back into the native tongue when they get excited. And so he's excitable on the set trying to, he's telling Monica repeatedly all throughout the day while they're on set, like bumping her shoulder, going, tell Pierce, the modern Bond must carry the modern Wolf, is what he kept saying. She's like, Wolf, I did tell him again, is what she kept saying. So, and that just went on and on. And then suddenly Pierce Brosnan gets the script redone to have that gun included in the final act. And talk about a man of true class. Not only does that happen, they had already done all of the promo photography for the movie. He had him do another set of photography. And that's how the P99 ended up on the poster for the film. So it didn't just end up like, oh, you know, yeah, there it is. It made it all the way to the posters. And then, you know, credit where credit's due for just Pierce Brosnan just being a great human being. A few years later, I think it was on the set of The World Is Not Enough. When they were filming that, Wolf and Monica showed back up and they're quietly sitting on the sidelines. They're not trying to get themselves in the way or anything like that. And Monica says that she hears a bellowing voice from all the way across the set, and it's Pierce Brosnan jumping upright, pointing and screaming, Wolf! So excited to see his friend from Walther running over to give him a bear hug.
I mean, to be fair, when awesome. people bring me free guns, I always remember and recognize them down the road too. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah, that's how you make friends for life.
That's right. Oh my goodness. Well, as always, when we talk with you, Caleb, it's something that we could do for hours on end, but unfortunately, nobody's schedule allows for that. So we've got to kind of wrap it up, but we really do appreciate you being on the show again, and want to remind everybody that they can find you online at Commando Bond on Instagram and your website and all that, and also on the new Steel and Style podcast that you guys have launched. It's you and Eli Duckworth with Cabot and Alchemy. And of course, people may remember that we had Eli on one episode of the show as well. And so if you remember the character that is Eli Duckworth from that episode, you can only imagine how remarkable the Steel and Style podcast must be. So give us your elevator pitch for what that podcast is all about.
Eli and I are very similar but very different people, which is why we get along so bloody well.
That's a great way to put it.
It is the true yin and yang. We're about the same age. We're very passionate about vintage things, but where I grew up watching Sean Connery on the big screen, he was obsessed with John Wayne in NASCAR. So, you know, he does a really great Macho Man impression. I do not. And so, you know, we have very different ways that we see things. And so in the same way we were talking about how like me, Ian, and James were always challenging each other and growing, that's one of the things with me and Eli being friends that's been so, so fun, is that we see the world in completely different ways, but we really like the same stuff. So he's teaching me about Swinson Bobcat 1911s, and I'm trying to preach to him why the P99 is a really cool polymer frame pistol, even though he thinks they're the devil. And that is kind of, you know, a lot of what we do. But so we talk about classic guns that influence us and their real world history. And then, of course, classic aesthetics, style, because the two go hand in hand. Because if you're going to carry a really cool gun, you best dress proper to match. Otherwise, you're just wasting everyone's time. So we get to talk about that stuff.
I mean, Clint Smith does say you dress around the gun. So I'm not sure he quite meant it from a sartorial fashion, but the lesson still applies.
All I'm saying is the PPK looks immaculate when you have a dinner jacket on. I have yet to find a better gun to do that with. I got married with one on in a suit in a dinner jacket, and it has not failed me yet.
Well, that's a beautiful way to.
I like to think that their positive experiences on this show is what led Eli and Caleb to decide to go down that road themselves. You know,
we're
starting things.
Yeah,
we're like, wow, the two of you are just such a blast. Yeah, we just need to do it ourselves. The problem was we wanted to do this for the better part of a year. So our first couple episodes were us just kind of making excuses as to why we both didn't make it happen. Like, you know, Eli spent 3 days staying with Ken Hackathorn at his private ranch shooting, and I was in Germany and this and that. So, you know, get to share some cool stories and then also go, but here's why we didn't get to record yet.
Of those 3 days shooting, right, at least a day and a half was spent on mustache maintenance. I mean, come on, let's be honest here.
Well, that's why Eli doesn't sleep. He had to look good for the man himself. If you're going to go shoot with the 1911 guy who has one of the best mustaches in the industry, like, are you going to let yourself down like that?
No. Consummate professional, that one.
Not if you're Eli.
And he also, you know, he had to make sure to brush out that chest hair, too, because his shirt doesn't get buttoned past the midsection. So, you know, when you bring your own sweater attached, you need to make sure that it looks proper. I get to say that specifically because he made a post on the Alchemy page the other day that said, legend has it, the moment Caleb started carrying his Alchemy 5-inch, his first 3 chest hairs sprouted. So, that was on the professional business account.
Oh my gosh. Well, just you got to continue to let Alan and I live in the lie that we're the ones that brought
whatever
you
it takes, guys.
or set the bar so low that you felt like you could do better quite easily.
Well, yeah, you know.
Ooh, you know what? That's actually probably more realistic.
We're like, hell, we could do this.
Scheme of things. Right, like if those chuckleheads can do it.
Well, I think if this book teaches me anything, I'm just too arrogant to say no. I'm like, I'll figure it out. I think that's the honest story of everything here. Is like, you mentioned it about how the book is probably one of the most incredible, like ridiculous undertakings. And the Headstamp guys have told me this is the most complex project they have ever touched. They will probably never touch a project this complex again because it's such a pain. It's amazing, don't get me wrong, but like dealing with film rights and film people and this and that and guns and pop culture and history, they're like, what did we do again? Like, you know, so when you throw all that together, like, it's a hell of a way to start, because I want to write a lot more, but it's only downhill, I guess, in terms of ease.
Well, it's not necessarily a bad thing to get all the hard stuff out of the way up front, you know, give yourself a little grace and a little bit of ease and relaxation, if those words can go together in the book writing and publishing mm-hmm. world, you know. But again, we appreciate you spending some time with us. Hopefully we haven't hurt you too bad, and we'll give you some time to get over this hurt, and then we'll have
sounds
you back
good.
Again.
We'll just have to get a drink and shot this year, boys.
So yes, most definitely we'll make it happen. Alrighty. Well, once again, thanks so much, Caleb Daniels, for being on this episode of the No Low Ballers podcast. And thanks to all of you who've tuned in to the audio and video versions of the show. We appreciate you listening and watching each and every week, because without you, there is no us. So make sure, please review the show. Leave us some comments, questions. We do read and respond to all that. And we appreciate you for that. And we will see each and every one of you right here on the next episode of the No Low Ballers podcast.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.